Welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Phil Brannan and Joe Kirk. Before we, you know, start the conversation, I would like to personally apologise on behalf of myself and Joe for the session, because we have not been mentally up to scratch as we were celebrating at the Real Cyber Awards last night. So it was a fun evening and we are paying for it today. You will soon find out.
Self-inflicted, well, though, so we've only got ourselves to blame.
Or well, Dave, yeah, we've got Dave to blame for the bottles of wine.
So well done for turning up and doing your bit.
Thanks.
We still didn't cover off accountability, did we? I mean, you spoke about it with Joe a couple of weeks ago when I was wherever I was in Scotland, I think, and you said, yeah, we'll just do an accountability tour and finish it off. And we didn't finish it off, did we? We still got accountability three to do.
I suspected this might happen. There's just so much to talk about because it's pretty much everything around data protection. It's the evidential side of it, but you know, it should be enshrined in an organization's practices. So how do you break that down in an hour or two?
What I like, tell me what bits you liked. What I like about accountability is the kind of the theoretical academic kind of discussion about it. You know, what is it? Therefore, how do you do it? How do you demonstrate it? And you know, the accountability principle, as I, you know, say frequently, you know, the seventh principle applies to the six principles above, not explicitly everything else that's in the GDPR. Although, of course, my absolute firm belief is that the principle of accountability, which is a different thing, is, you know, immersed right throughout the GDPR. And therefore, you know, the two things are distinctly different. You know, we talked about accountability principle only relating to controls, not processes. So there's quite a lot of stuff we chatted through. And that I think I like that bit of it, you know, just, you know, kicking about, you know, the concepts of it. What bits do you think you liked, apart from the end when you could go back to crawling under your desk?
Joe?
I liked about the accountability principle. I think what I like about it is that, you know, data protection, as we know, is what many organizations consider a tick box exercise. So what I like about it is, without using the word again, it actually holds organizations accountable, doesn't it, to what they're doing. You know, it's one thing saying that you work towards compliance with the GDPR, but it's another thing actually showing it. And, you know, I think that's what's really good about the principle. And you're right, Phil, the session, we didn't really quite, you know, get to grips with it, because it's just everywhere, isn't it? We spoke about it in areas, and I think there's still three areas, isn't there, of the ICO's accountability framework that we're yet to talk on. So stay tuned for a part three.
Yeah, I like how, you know, the level of depth that you can look into with accountability, because every stone unturned, you find, I'm going to make my own phrase up here, 20 million more worms. Like, there's just so much. When you look into a specific area, there's so much more to that area itself. And it's really complex, but I think you can really get stuck into it. So, you know, there's the overall compliance aspect. Say, for, let's look at transparency, you know, having privacy notices, but then taking that further, have they been regularly reviewed? Are people updated with these, you know, are people informed of these updates? What layers of information are you providing? Things like that. There's so much to it that, yeah, it's fun to unpick.
What constantly disappoints me is the, you know, surely the best measure of accountability is to have enforced audits. You know what I mean? So even if it was, you know, if we have, you know, different, you know, the processing activities like this, or your organization above that size, you know, why doesn't the law require, like other things require, a formal external audit or a formal internal audit? But, you know, it's one of the key things I think is missing.
I would agree, and I think that would really help with the ICO as well. in really driving the importance of data protection and that message of data protection across all organisations, because, you know, it does seem like an uphill battle at times in spreading the data protection word. But it's a good point, Phil. But without further ado, I don't want to get into a second session on the prelude. We hope you enjoy the session. We probably will be back for an accountability part 3, so stay tuned for that. And yeah, thank you, Phil and Joe, for joining me, and thank you in advance for your patience with us. So Phil, I don't know if you've had chance to listen back, you know. I'm sure it's been at the top of your to-do list. But
so what did we cover last time? Because I was away when you did this before. Yeah. So what did you cover before? Well, so, before we dive into this, yeah, I haven't really seen much of the news this week, have you?
I've covered one piece of news, and it's to do with body cams. So Lidl are to become the first supermarket where all of their staff will be wearing body cams. The purpose, they say, is for staff protection and security. It's going to be investing over £2 million in ensuring every store in its network has the new security measures. The rollout is set to be completed by spring 2024. I've got quite a few comments on this myself. Mainly around the lawful basis for which they will be relying on for this. I presume it will be legitimate interests. However, you know, I'd quite like to see the legitimate interest assessment if they carry one out. Quite fitting with today's podcast, actually, being accountable. Simply because I don't think their interests of protecting security and staff will outweigh the rights and freedoms of the individuals, because I believe it will be recording, you know, people at all times. So it'll be picking up on just general chit chat at work and that sort of stuff. So I think they'll be quite careful with what they're doing with
that. Entirely intrusive, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? Absolutely. And I think Jasmine also pointed out the idea of picking up special category data, you know, if it's picking up individuals that are in a wheelchair. And I had a little look through on, I think substantial public interest will probably be the most, well, the most promising.
Yeah, but that's a tricky area, isn't it? So I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think the ICO's guidance is that if CCTV picks up a wheelchair user, that's not special category data unless the intention is to identify that person as a wheelchair user. But if you then use it for some other purpose, like for helping, you know, a particular customer to access the toilet, for instance, then it would become a special category data. I think that's one of those odd ones where the ICO's guidance says it's very purpose and intent based.
Yeah, well, that's I've not thought about that, so thanks for that, Phil. But also second to that, when you are doing the legitimate interest assessment, you know, it asks you, doesn't it, can you achieve the purposes by doing it in another way? And I think absolutely they can do it in another way. You know, CCTV, I'm sure they have CCTV in stores anyway, but I think limiting it to specific members of staff or even just security guards would probably be the more beneficial way of achieving the goal than giving it to all members of staff.
I think it's you know, what you're getting at is proportionality, isn't it? And I would like to know more information around how long the recordings are stored, if they are, or if you could, you know, backtrack an hour or so if an incident occurs or something like that. Like you say, I'd be intrigued to know what measures they've got in place around it.
Yeah, Carl's put something in the chat saying that he read that they were providing cameras for all employees but were allowing staff to decline. Yeah, you might be right, Carl. I've not really read up too much on it. It was just a news story I'd come across and thought I'd share my thoughts on that. So thanks for that, Carl. Very useful. How about you guys? Did you guys see anything in the news this week? I've been a little bit wrapped up with the work I've been doing, so I've not seen a great deal.
No, I saw that the ICO is seeking to appeal the Clearview AI ruling. So, you know, the questions and concerns that we had around the case, they are going to put forward. So I'll be intrigued to see how that one progresses. It seems right that this has come about, because obviously we've had so many questions around how they've come to that decision, the first tier tribunal. So yeah, that's I thought that was very, very interesting.
That'd be interesting to see how that works out. I read two really, really interesting but very long articles, one written by Bird and Bird, and one that somebody highlighted last week, actually, the Amber Hawk, the Hawk Talk, Amber Talk from Vincent Mason's, is that, does that, Hawk Talk, about that. They're really interesting to sort of dig into it. And I'm not surprised that the ICO has gone to appeal on it. I think it's a really important point. But this particular thing I read from Hawk Talk, I'll have to share it because it's really, really interesting. It's quite long. I'll just put that in the chat here. They're basically, you have to read it. I can't really paraphrase. It's 15 pages that needs to be. You need to think it through, really. But they're saying that the way that the UK GDPR has been drafted with this relevant processing, and also the data protection DPDI bill and digital information bill, they're saying the way that that's describing the definition or slightly changed the definition of personal data, what this article is arguing is that a lot of CCTV systems will fall outside of the definition of processing personal data, which is like, wow, crikey, you have to read it. I can't explain in 5 minutes here what it says, but it's really good to read because it's kind of they're pulling apart the definitions and they're applying them and they're breaking down into three or four different component parts, and the conclusion is that a lot of CCTV systems will be not caught by the GDPR because they won't be processing personal data because the DPDI bill has changed the definition of personal data.
Right.
Slightly. Yeah, but I mean, it's worth reading. I mean, again, this is devil's advocate, people like chucking in the hand grenade, you know, type of thing. So, but there are a couple of things worth reading.
Thanks for that.
The only other thing I saw in the news was Southampton nightclub trialing facial recognition. Again, this thing I've just referred to, that Amber Hawk, this Hawk Talk article, basically they conclude by saying, you know, if this is the case that CCTV systems aren't caught by GDPR, then expect to see an explosion in their use and in the use of facial recognition and AI, linked up to them. So interesting to see how that develops.
It's funny that when I read about the using facial recognition in nightclubs, it's, you know, you hear facial recognition, and I don't know about other people, but you know, you stiffen up a little bit thinking, oh, it's a bit intrusive, this and that. But the purpose for using it in nightclubs to, you know, protect people from getting spiked, for example, then, you know, it says, oh, thanks, Joe. Stop sharing the screen. Every week. I've thrown off now.
Nightclubs.
It's a good, you know, it's a good reason. It instills a bit of reassurance that you will be protected, you know, because if you think about it, there are some clubs that already they'll scan your passport and look at it, you know, on a big screen when you're going in. It's not too dissimilar from that if you're going to compare it against those systems anyway. I think it's just changing the narrative in your head every now and again, but having the faith that it will be used in an appropriate way. So that's where the concern comes.
I've been watching The Door, so I've not paid full attention to your chat. Is the use of the facial recognition for getting in, or is it for once you're in there as well? Is it for security purposes? Yeah.
No, it's okay. Well, it's trying to deter predators preying on women. This is specific UK in Southampton. So they're scanning people on the way in, and they're seeing if they've got any kind of note about them as an individual. So
all right.
Yeah, I've got no problems for, you know, facial recognition being used for those sort of things, you know, because the nightlife, it can get a little bit it can get bad. Get bad. It's, honestly, my brain's not working today, so you have to bear with me. But yeah. You know,
you're probably still a bit tipsy.
When it's being used for those sort of purposes, you know, I don't have a problem with it. But recording for the sake of recording for things like in a supermarket just seems a little bit over the top, in my opinion.
Yeah, thank you for the correction, Cynthia. I wasn't aware actually that Amber Hawk train. I thought I somehow got the two mixed together, that they were part of Pinsent Masons, but they do write some excellent stuff. Dr. Chris Pounder, he writes some amazing, you know, really good stuff. It has done for years. Some very, very good materials. Michael wants to talk about the Article 9 for face recognition.
Yeah, well, I had a little look in, I thought substantial public interest were probably the most appropriate. So I had a little look in Schedule 1 and I found, I think it's paragraph 10, it's detecting unlawful acts, I believe, was the one was probably most appropriate.
Yeah, but does it detect? I mean,
is it not preventing as well?
It's preventive.
It is preventing or detecting unlawful acts, yeah, yes. Yeah. Apologies.
I was playing devil's advocate.
Just being picky.
Rightly so.
Yeah. Have you seen anything else in the news this week?
No, I thought there was a lot in the news, but nothing that was particularly... I mean, there's a lot of old stuff, you know, about the ICO's code of practice on monitoring, and there was some stuff about the children's code, and there's stuff about AI and... but nothing I thought meat enough to raise up today. And I don't think there's anything we had a ton of stuff last week to talk about. I don't think we talked about it all, but I can't remember what we wanted to talk about, didn't have time for. So we'll have to move on from that stuff.
Can everyone hear?
Carry on.
Yeah, going back to that Clearview AI case, it was, so I was reading an article from IAPP and they were talking about inconsistencies in the judgment. So the first tier tribunal found that Clearview AI were for two different processing activities, a controller and then a joint controller, but also highlighted them as a processor in the same activities. So, you know, that comes back to our question of what the relationship actually was and then their responsibility within that. But I thought it was just a really, really,
muddled thinking. Just,
but it's reassuring.
Not what you're saying now, muddled thinking.
Well, it is. it's reassuring tribunal. To read that, though, because obviously we had these questions and they are validated through this. It's because it just doesn't make sense, basically. So I am really interested in keeping up to date with that one.
Yeah. Oh, the only other one thing I noticed was, and I missed this in the King, we were talking about the King's speech last week, weren't we? And we talked about the DPDI bill being mentioned, but also there's mentioned the changes to the Investigatory Powers Act. Mm, so we talked about the Investigatory Powers Act a few weeks ago, didn't we? And you know, the relationship between RIPA and the IPA. And anyway, according to what I've read, there's not any major changes to the IPA proposed, but there are some changes that, you know, if they've got parliamentary time, might well make it through.
All right.
So I think that's probably, unless everybody's got anything else that they saw in the news that's worth kicking about. But otherwise, where did you get to then with the accountability last time you looked at it? Because it's quite a big topic, isn't it?
Yeah. So to break it down and, you know, refresh some of the listeners' memories as well, we're exploring the idea of accountability or the principle of accountability. Yeah. And we decided to, because accountability is so broad, there is so much to it. It's, you know, a question of what level of detail do you go into, what area do you go into. So we decided to go with the ICO's accountability framework, which is separated into 10 areas, and decided to just explore those ideas, you know, keeping it refined to each area as closely as we could, because there's so much overlap, and work through them. So what did we go through? We discussed leadership and oversight, policies and procedures, training and awareness, and individual rights. And then there was so much conversation around that's where we got up to.
So you're working through the ICA's accountability framework?
Yeah. So just the relevance of each of these areas and how you make sure that, or just, I don't know if you call it tips or conversation around what they entail, how you comply with them, what's best practice, what's above and beyond and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, everyone thinks, a lot of people think that the accountability principle was brand new in the GDPR, but it was in the Data Protection Act as well, in the previous directive. So it's been around as a concept, not the accountability principle, but the principle of accountability. So the two slightly different things. So it's not anything that's new. So really, there should have been processes and systems in place to, you know, demonstrate accountability already in place before GDPR came into into effect. But, you know, I'm not sure that they were. And the accountability tracker certainly didn't exist prior to GDPR, did it?
A little bit before time, I think, there, Phil.
There we go again.
History lessons. Here's history lessons. So you covered off. So how did and how did you do this last time? Sorry for being a bit the pace here, but what was the general thrust of it? You know,
we just had a bit of a chat, didn't we, really, Jasmine? It was just a two-way conversation. We followed the accountability frameworks. It made sense to go in that order, and we kind of just, you know, spoke about what we'd do, I guess, in a nutshell. You know, our sort of tips of how we'd be accountable into each specific area.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you want to start with transparency and just work our way down, or.
Yeah, I think transparency in and of itself is so broad. You know, there's different levels to it. There's certain things that you need to consider to upkeep it, to create it in the first place, to make sure people are aware of where to find this information and whatnot. And it's a constant mission, really.
I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curved ball here. So I was looking through the notes from last time, and I noticed when you're talking about training and you're talking about slides and this, that, next thing. But what, you know, slides is fine and e-learning is fine, but really kind of making it fun and gamifying it is really. Do you remember when we used to do training? We had a game in the middle of the training called Breach or No Breach, which is basically a rip-off of The Apprentice Hired or Fired, where you span a bottle on the screen, and then up came a thing, you know, this is what's happened, you know, is it a breach or isn't it a breach, is it a reportable breach, and we gave out cards, green and orange, green and red cards that we'd made, you know, dead simple things, and people held them up and waved them if they thought it was a reportable breach. But I found some quite interesting, I need to go and buy some of these games, I found some quite interesting games on the, you know, the commercially available games, like Data Heist, a cyber hygiene and data protection game, for £40, a load of things called the data protection game. So these are quiz cards. And we've put quiz cards together before to do training. In fact, we put a snakes and ladders together once to do data protection training. And I found that the GDPR board game, which apparently ISACA made, they're the people, I think, that were behind the Cyber Essentials. So there's quite a lot of games out there that you know, either is the training or, you know, is a way to break up the training or role play or things. But I don't know whether you kind of talked about that before. We even bought yes and no buzzers. You know, they were in the office ages, weren't they? So when you were doing a quiz in a training environment, it was a bit more interactive, you know. Just simple stuff like that, just to try and make it more memorable.
I always say, when it comes to raising awareness and getting people on board with data protection, I think I mentioned last week that I think people see it as, you know, the law, and the law isn't their area, even though, you know, they need to know, say, for example, health and safety and whatnot. It's I don't think they realize the responsibility on them and how relevant it actually is to everyday life. You know, your training, Phil, the induction training, introduction to data protection, it goes through, is it Bill?
Bill's day.
He wakes up and he goes on his phone and, you know, searches through, I don't even know, Instagram or something. They're collecting his data. Then he goes and takes the train and pays by card. Yeah, that kind of thing. And when he pays, I've just remembered as well. We'll talk about that next week. I had a conversation with Vaughan last week about I think it was the TFL, Transport for London? Collecting credit card data or debit card data, and through him just scanning. But we'll talk about that on a GDPR radio session. But
I seem to remember.
Sorry, my brain's going off on one.
some years ago, that I think it was a housing association got done for some kind of misdemeanor, and they created a data protection game for training. Internal training, and I can't remember which one it was, and I had to look through the SharePoint before I joined this, because I can't remember which one it was, but again, that was a really novel approach to try and, you know, improve the quality and the memorableness of the training. Anyway, you covered training and awareness last week, but interestingly, in the ICA's framework, they do separate the two things as being distinctly different, don't they? So they talk about training and they talk about awareness being distinctly different. What did you make? Go on.
In terms of awareness, obviously transparency plays a part in that. Would you say that it's transparency is effective in terms of, you know, the public knowledge of data protection, or awareness comes alongside that? Obviously, there's two ways to look at it. So there's awareness to individuals and awareness to staff in enforcing data protection requirements. But where do you think that stands? Do you think that transparency has an important role in it? Do you think that it's working?
I think that transparency is on the... You obviously looked at the ICO's accountability tracker,
mm-hmm.
that spreadsheet. Again, I'm interested to know if anybody uses that or has used it or has seen it being used. I'd have to say I've never seen it being used by anybody. But staff awareness is also one of those things on the accountability tracker, section 5.5. So what the ICO is seemingly expecting that it says here you arrange organization-wide staff training about privacy information. So the transparency bit seems to be more about privacy information than anything else. Frontline staff receive more specialized or specific training. That's about awareness and transparency of policy, I suppose. Staff awareness is part of transparency, and I think it wouldn't be on this accountability tracker if the ICO didn't think that as well.
Nicholas said in the chat, we've started going through, it's quite repetitive though.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's useful. Is it good? Is it, interesting to... I mean, it's very similar to kind of audit questions, really. When we talk about the audit handbook, but these are questions that a data protection practitioner would be asking of their organization. It's potentially marking your own homework, but I think it looks quite useful, quite usable. I don't know whether Nicola's got any thoughts as to whether it's usable or not. I mean, it's going to be repetitive. You're going to be phrasing the same types of questions, but about different things.
And they will relate to each other as well. Training and awareness of your policies and procedures, for example. Sorry, go on, Phil.
I'm just saying, Laura's put in, it was used as the evidence base to write a strategy, which again, probably quite useful, because if you take all the questions on the about accountability tracker and then get in your helicopter and go up above it all and have a look down over it, then that might help you formulate an approach or a strategic approach to compliance management. So I can see it would be useful for that. And somebody said that they'd like to, but having the resource and the time is the issue. Well, yes, it is, isn't it? For everybody, it's just trying to prioritising what you need to get around to. But the majority of this transparency bit is about the privacy notice, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I took from it. I think more than Jasmine's kind of aimed towards training.
I was just kind of linking the training and awareness to transparency, to be fair.
that's fair enough. But like you say, Phil, for me, it's mainly around privacy policies. And I think it's something that is fundamental for organisations to get right, but it's something that I see quite regularly wrong. When I was back in my time when I was in sales, I'd spent quite a bit of time going through privacy policies and having a look through. I mean, at the time, I wasn't particularly well versed in data protection, so I wasn't quite sure what I was looking for. But one of the main things that I would see was that they'd not been reviewed and amended in almost 5 years at the time, because it was, people would write them back in 2018 and kind of just leave them alone. But you can't do that, can you? You need to update them regularly, because your processing changes constantly as an organisation. The fundamentals stay the same, don't they? But you might have things that change, or you might start something new.
You might do. I mean, I think they need to be checked regularly and verified that they're accurate. I don't know that processing wildly changes in most organisations. You reach an operational level and that doesn't generally change unless you're doing something radically new, or maybe you doing things in a different way, maybe using AI or other more modern tools to achieve the same outcomes. Or maybe you're a supermarket, you're introducing body worn cams and facial recognition, so all that kind of stuff. But what really irritates me though is when I look at a privacy notice and it says it was last reviewed last year or whatever, and it's still completely got bits missing out of it. I think, well, who's reviewed it, and what were they looking for, and why did they not notice these things that I can see are wrong?
Yeah, I was talking to a customer yesterday and they were on about their record of processing activities, saying that while they have them in place, they implemented them in 2018 and they get annually reviewed. It's unlikely that they're actually, you know, being reviewed in depth and updated in depth. It's if it's past the process owner who's got a million other things to do, they're just going to glance, skim through it and say, yep, that's fine, 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 rather than really thinking, okay, what, you know, going through the process of or thought process of what might have changed, what needs updating, and so on.
So what the accountability tracker is asking us to look at is number one, the content. So, you know, is it got all the required elements in it? Has it got all the rights? And has it got all the processing activities? Has it got the legitimate interest assessment, et cetera, et cetera? Has it got all that content that's required by Article 13? And interestingly, 14, which if we've got time, we ought to have a think about that as well. Then it's asking us to think about, you know, how is that privacy information and when is that privacy information presented to data subjects? And if it changes, you know, if it's a significant change, how do you refresh it? And there's a whole host of stuff in there. But accountability is about being able to demonstrate, you know, compliance, isn't it? So where's the evidence to show that these things have been done or are in place? And then the third element is effective. You know, is your privacy information effective? Yeah, you've written it and yeah, you give distributed that, but do people understand it? You know, is it written in understandable terms? Well, I think the only way to find that out is to go out to people and ask them. You know, do a mini survey, you know. But again, if you imagine that you've got this kind of level of, I understand everyone's going to be jumping on my head saying resource your time, blah, blah, blah. But if you imagine that you did have that kind of evidence to show, yeah, we've got it all content wise, we've got it all distributed at the right point in time, and we know people understand it and like it and it resonates with them because we've got evidence, we've done it. Any question the ICO comes to you with, you know, you've got some really good defensible position there because you've got some fantastic evidence. But, you know, this is my ivory tower, you know, rather than the reality of how it is as an operator. It's asking then about, you know, automated decision making, you know, is there any going on and is it on the things? And then staff awareness, are the staff aware of the privacy information and what it means and how it, you know, constrains what they're doing, or maybe if they do something new that they understand that it's got to be put onto the privacy information, and then kind of periodic review, you know, and how often should it be reviewed, you know, making a log. It says keep a log of privacy notice reviews, keep a log of old privacy notices, because ultimately if somebody kind of agrees effectively to a privacy notice and it changed over time, you need to know what they agreed to at that point in time, don't you, when you presented it to them. So that again is quite a complicated task really, to make sure that you know if it is moving rapidly, Joe, as you say, which data subject has signed up to what privacy notices. You know, that is,
but with that
quite
though,
a complex dynamic.
If a privacy notice has been updated, it's the controller's responsibility to inform data subjects of those updates as well.
Yeah, it absolutely, yes. Yeah. So how do you do that? In some environments, it's easier than others. You know, some you actually know your customers, but if they're just, you know, consumers that are jumping on a website and buying stuff, it's very hard to actively push out, you know, privacy information. Let's say you started profiling old customers and you've got this ability to do anonymous checkout, you know, but you still might have delivery information, but you don't have to sign up for an account. Then how are you going to know? Notify people, you know, might have a defunct email address. I don't know, you know, but yeah, I agree that there's an obligation to push out updated privacy information, but in some environments it's easier. I always think you got to use multiple channels, so you know, where you can put letters through people's doors. If you've got a magazine, you know, like our housing clients have got these annual reports that they distribute, so you could put something in that. You know, you could put it in your rent statement, you could put it on your website. If you've got a portal, you could put it on a splash screen as you go through the portal. There's loads of different opportunities for doing it, and I think you need to have I've done this with a few clients. I think you need to have a kind of a strategic approach, communication approach to updating privacy information. Of course, all of that is time consuming, it's all resource intensive. Some of it might be cost, you know, as well. But as I say, we're in our ivory tower today.
Yeah.
The world is rose tinted.
One of the areas that I personally think is most neglected is record of process on a lawful basis. So, you know, you see it a lot of times where an organization who, you know, aren't up to scratch, let's say, with the data protection, will say, oh, we rely on consent for that, but they don't have any records of consent. The consent form might not be meet, you know, the requirements for valid consent, or be sufficient in that sense. They might not have refresh the consents, that's just consent alone. Then you get legitimate interests, and have they done an LIA, legitimate interest assessment? I think quite often that's not the case, but then when would you think it's suitable to do a legitimate interest assessment? You know, do you judge that by the scale of process, and there are questions around that as well. Appropriate policy documents under Schedule 1 of the Data Protection Act, when do you really see them? You know, there is a lot to lawful bases, but how much of that is implemented in practice, I think it's probably not as equal.
LIAs is an interesting, go on, Joe.
No, I was just touching on what Jasmine said about lawful bases. When I read privacy policies, sometimes organizations will say, you know, we rely on legitimate interest, but they don't actually state which process and activity is relied upon by legitimate interest. So we recommend organizations to have a table, don't we, where it says the purpose and then the subsequent lawful basis which are relying on for that purpose of processing.
Yeah, and didn't the ICO was very critical of, is it TikTok recently, about their privacy notice? They basically rubbished it, didn't they? But they were saying, you know, you really ought to have, you know, that type of approach, you know, with processing activity, lawful basis, explain legitimate interest, retention in a tabular format. But you're right, and, you know, so often you read a privacy notice and it's kind of general description processing, and then, you know, and we're doing it for this and this lawful grounds, but no indication to which processing activity has got which lawful basis to it.
And then you see as well, you know, we rely on legitimate interests, but it doesn't state what those legitimate interests actually are.
No, that's right. I mean, and LIAs are very interesting as well, because again, the GDPR is not explicitly saying you need to do an LIA. It says you need to balance the rights, doesn't it? But it doesn't say, and the way to do it is an LIA. The ICO expects to see an LIA, but, you know, if you've got a lot of processing based on a legitimate interest, I my own view is I'd do an LIA if I thought I needed to. If I didn't think I needed to, because it was to me a quite clearly legitimate interest. Like one of those that's called out in the GDPR, like marketing, general marketing, though I wouldn't see the need to do an LIA. But if it was something that I thought, well, maybe this is a little bit encroaching on people's rights, then I would do an LIA. So whether that is compliant behaviour or not and satisfies the accountability tracker, don't know.
I don't disagree with that, Phil. Because you're right, there are some that are, you know, they're so obvious, aren't they, when you have an overriding legitimate interest. I think I had a instance recently with a customer who reached out, and they shared an individual's name and address with a bed bug company or a pest control company, one of the two. And she complained to the housing association that they did so without her consent. And I said, well, you know, you don't need to rely on consent as long as it was a legitimate interest. And she complained to the ICO in the end. And with that, I just found it so obvious that there was an overriding legitimate interest of sharing that individual's contact details in order to, you know, solve the issue of pests, you know, in the back garden. I think sometimes, like you say, Phil, it's obvious, isn't it?
I'm pretty sure she requested that as well, from memory. Talking with you,
honestly, sometimes data subjects complain, and I think you've not really got a leg to stand on here. You know, you've asked the housing associate. I don't think she was even a tenant either. She reached out to I think the neighboring property was a tenant, and she reached out saying, look, I want, you know what, just do it, just get it sorted. And then when the housing association shared the details, she had the cheek to go and complain to the ICO that they did so without her consent. So I was just, honestly, sometimes it's really baffling, quite fun as well to see.
this on my screen, which I'm sharing, is what Michael has put a link to, which I mean, I have to have a go at this, the Twitter data dash. I mean, I just clicked on start a minute ago and it didn't actually do anything. Maybe my computer's, I don't know, but I can't get to anything. But I mean, it looks really good.
not too bad for you, actually.
No, I've been shutting some down. So that was quite, it was quite fun, actually. That
I thought you were going to play me that. I want me to watch you play that.
Oh, I am doing it. It's playing now. Oh, I've got. Hang on a second. I've got it. It's got a lot of music going on. I've got you talking.
Phil, did you have a drink as well last night?
Irish coffee. Oh, and he's gone.
I'll have to have a go at it later on, but it started blasting me with a load of music whilst you were talking.
That's how it's like when leveling up your Vipex starts calling when I'm on a call.
Yeah. So you wanted to talk about records post activities and lawful basis processing. Again, in terms of accountability, the big question on ROPAs is how granular do you make them? We were going through some stuff with a customer yesterday, me and Matthew, and they're asking us questions about, should we do this and should we do that? And we said, well, actually, we don't know. You ought to have a policy on how granular you're going to do them, and to make sure that everybody in the organisation who is responsible for putting these ROPAs together is doing it in a relatively consistent manner. Otherwise, you're going to find that some are too high level, some are too detailed.
It's the balance,
some are interpreting. Yeah. Well, it's a balance, but it's setting the rules out to start with. It was actually relating to the data-wise system. We've put a field in place for you to record this information, but what you put in it in that field, really depends on what your DPO wants you to put in that field. How detailed to make it. We've put in a field for when it's a lawful basis, you've got to then fill in a text box basically. And we said, well, what we want in there is if you've ticked legitimate interest, we want you to explain legitimate interest. If you've ticked off legal obligation, we want you to explain what is the legal obligation, where is it, where does it manifest itself? Is it a code of practice? Is it legislation? If you're saying public, tasks around the public interest or public authority, then explain what it is. But we've just, all our job was to do is to put a facility for you to record that information. But if your DPO says I'll just leave it blank, then fine. But if your DPO says no, populate it with some meaningful information to make the ROPA come to life, then fine. But I wrote a how to review ROPAs the other week for our support desk, and it's actually quite interesting. So I was taking, really just putting all the knowledge we've got from auditing ROPAs into a document that we could use internally for training. But they're usually, you look at ROPAs and they're usually not right, not enough information and gaps in them and last reviewed 5 years ago. And
yeah, that's a big one.
But what I'm interested about in the accountability framework, and the ICO's first point is your organization frequently carries out comprehensive data mapping exercises. So all those people saying, this is very resource intensive, absolutely is. How frequently do we expect this to happen, and how comprehensive? And what if our environment isn't changing much? We're a school, we don't really do much different. There's nothing that changes really about our pressing. Do you still expect to do it every month or every term, in intricate detail? I mean, date mapping is a very time consuming process, isn't it? And I'm just wondering whether it's necessary really to go to these extremes, to get the evidence of accountability. Is it necessary? Is it over egging it?
Well, there's different things to consider there, isn't there? So it's, I guess, what's a reasonable amount of time for that specific organization? And then on top of that, what level of depth for, say, for example, a smaller organization, it's going to be an organization that processes minimal data, it's going to be a smaller task compared to a larger organization. So there's two, it's like a two-pronged approach to it, really, or way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think they probably ought to have a look at this and maybe update it, because the ROPA also includes, I'm reading it off the accountability framework, the tracker, so if you want me to share the screen, I will, but 6.4, good practice for ROPAs, ROPAs also includes links to documents. Well, it doesn't work if there's multiple documents. You've got loads of hyperlinks then that you might not be able to access them. People might not have permission to access those documents. So I get where they're coming from, and I quite like the accountability framework. and the tracker. But you know, I do think you can't take it literally. I think you have to take bits that work for you out of it and apply it so that it works for you.
Yeah, because we've got a couple of versions of Ropers, haven't we? We've got a complete, full, comprehensive one with loads of information to complete, and then a simplified one that goes just above, you know, the minimum required. So it includes lawful basis, which isn't a requirement under Article 30. And I guess it's what suits an organisation more, but at the same time, you know, where they're up to as well. So in terms of data protection, if they... you know, if they've got nothing in place, you're going to start small because you might not have your DPIAs yet. So at least by, you know, getting the information down, then you can look towards the bigger projects or the subsequent projects afterwards.
Fundamentally, you know, what is accountability? You know, that's the heart of this. You know, if this is a accountability principle, you know, what actually does it mean? You know, accountability. And how far do you have to go? What do you have to do to be able to demonstrate accountability? That's what's the heart of this, isn't it? And for me,
it depends.
Well, I think I think accountability is about being able to demonstrate compliance with the rules. You know, it's a shift from being kind of bureaucratic compliance. You know, we've ticked some boxes. This is about being able to demonstrate something is alive, it's active, it's a living and breathing system, and it's therefore it's got, you know, reviews and it's got people interacting with it. And there should be things that arise because you've got a systematic approach, you know, like DPIAs, because you've got a DPIA policy and a procedure. You know, the whole thing, you know, to me, and DPIAs is in the accountability framework, isn't it? But it's not a principle. The seventh principle is about complying with the principles above. It's not then about going into breach management unless it's relating to the sixth security principle. It's not about DPIAs. So what the accountability track does is it goes further than the seventh principle, in my view. It starts thinking about the principle of accountability as well as the accountability principle, i.e. the seventh principle.
Because it includes best practice there as well. You know, if you think about the requirement for controllers to have in place appropriate technical and organizational measures, it doesn't specify, okay, you need a data sharing agreement and this is what needs to be included in it, but that would help with the accountability principle that is seen as best practice. There's a lot of elements like that.
I want to play a little bit of devil's advocate here with you, Phil, because you said that it doesn't, you know, accountability doesn't quite link to DPIAs because it says you know, accountable to the principles above. But could you not say that you carry out a DPIA to ensure that processing is fair, transparent and lawful? So it kind of does entwine a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, you carry out a DPIA in theory where you think processing might present a high risk to people's rights and freedoms, don't you? So if you don't do a DPIA because you don't think it's a high risk to people's rights and freedoms, then you wouldn't do one. So yeah, it is linked in a way, Joe, but you know, this is what we like about working with the GDPR is it open to interpretation.
So going on to the next one of contracts and data sharing, I think that's timely, to be fair. There's various ways in which you can demonstrate your accountability here. Go on, Phil.
I was going to say just another point on the accountability principle. Of course, it's only applicable to controllers, isn't it? So why is that? Why aren't processors also, you know, to be held accountable with the, you know, with the principles? The principles only apply to anybody, don't they? Personal data shall be there to principles. It doesn't say controllers shall. It says personal data shall be, you know, lawfully processed, etc. But the seventh principle only applies to controllers. The controller shall be responsible for and be able to demonstrate compliance. Paragraph one, you know, why aren't processors also caught by that, you know, need to demonstrate accountability? Just interesting thought. I don't know, maybe it's not, maybe it's just
I don't think I've ever noticed that, Phil.
Really?
I probably shouldn't
admit that.
Well, if you think
well
about
I just assumed that processors, like you say, why would it not include processors, like you?
Because it's the controller that determines the means and purposes of the process, and so they set the tone for all of these things. So
yeah,
it's not a processor's job to establish a lawful basis.
Well, what about security?
Well,
is that not a principle?
Well, I mean, that's caught by Article 28, isn't it? So.
Maybe.
It is in
maybe.
The
anyway, sorry,
though,
what were you asking
it?
Before we dive off down this tangent? Yeah, it is, yeah. Contracts and data sharing were you talking
yes,
about?
Yes, speaking of which, Article 28. yeah, so there's various ways in which, you know, you need to ensure that you've got or comply with the accountability principle in relation to this. So having in place, first of all, policies and procedures for appointing data processors and for engaging with third parties when you're data sharing. Due diligence processes, contracts, including data processing agreements under Article 28. But then if you want to go above and beyond data sharing agreements, which are actually specified in this accountability tracker, which obviously you're saying goes above and beyond.
But not the accountability principle.
Exactly. And not specifically stated in the GDPR. I guess it
but
alluded
the thing about
to.
The account- Yeah, that's the thing about accountability is that, you know, accountability is a very broad term, isn't it? And then you have to applaud the ICF for putting this together, because you've then got to think, well, what does that mean to me? What have I got to do then to be able to demonstrate that I've got things in place here? And yes, it's the starting point. I've got a policy on it. I've got some standard operating procedures about how to do it. I've got some records that are created because we're following the procedures. You know, we've got a log of processes, we've got a process of contract, we've got some evidence of due diligence, you know, and it might be, you know, that type of due diligence for that type of client processor and that type of due diligence for a different type of processor. But this is about having, I think, documentary evidence of a living, breathing process. You know, that's what, to me, what this accountability is about, you know, that you need to be able to pull out that evidence and allow an independent auditor effectively to recreate those things you're claiming to have in place. Yeah, we have got contracts in place. Show me. There you go. You know, has it got all the elements of Article 28 in it? Yep, you know, show me the contract. Oh, it's online. It's a master service agreement with Microsoft. You know, has it got all the elements in it? Is it international transfers? Has it got a mechanism in there? Oh, one thing I noticed, I got an email today from Cloudflare, and Cloudflare have notified me that they are adopting the data protection framework as their lawful basis for transfers to the US, which is the first time I've actually had a notification from someone that they effectively doing that. Sorry,
yeah,
that's
interesting. On the area of contracts and data sharing, I think an area that gets overlooked quite often is due diligence, in my opinion. So where does due diligence come from? Well, Article 28 says when...
Does it get overlooked or does it get avoided? Because it's
probably avoided. But anyway, sorry, Phil. When processing is carried out on behalf of a controller, the controller shall only use processors providing sufficient guarantees to implement appropriate technical organisational measures in such a manner that the processor will meet the requirements of this regulation. So, you know, only use processors that are providing sufficient guarantees is the key here. And how do you find that out? Well, you have to go and, you know, do some research on the processor that you are wanting to engage with. Phil, me and you have spoken on here, haven't we, before about due diligence on a GDPR radio a few months ago. And I think to summarize, we kind of went with the approach that it's not really a one size fits all sort of thing. I think it depends on the processing that is occurring and how deep you have to go on that sort of research that you're carrying out and what is actually sufficient, you know, measures to ensure that it's kept safe. So I think we broke down, didn't we, and said that if you're engaging with someone just for the purpose of sharing emails and names and stuff, then, you know, you're not going to be expecting to see ISO 27001, for example, you know, and those sort of things. But I'm just thinking now you can go down quite a rabbit hole here with this sort of stuff, can't you? Because ISO 27001 on a website, you know, you have a statement of applicability, don't you? So it's not always relevant to what you're actually looking for. So, you know, I don't think it's an easy thing to navigate due diligence. I don't know what your two thoughts on this are.
I think it is something, it depends on the internal process of the organization and, well, the procurement process more than anything. You can do your best to standardize it through a questionnaire like we've got, but there are levels to that, and for some organizations it can be overkill, whereas for others, you know, it's really it's crucial to go into a good level of detail. It's that question of whether it's an audit, you know, can you justify it as one, or are you actually you know, is there any evidence of their measures, of their, I think, you know, what they claim to have?
I think it's a very tricky thing. I think one of the problems is using a questionnaire approach. So yes, we've got a questionnaire approach, and I was on with Vicky a couple of days, it might have been yesterday, I can't remember, but she's been asked to sign off, right, two processes for a client. One is the soft is payroll service, and the other one was employee benefits service. So, you know, the starting point for me is, well, what could go wrong here? What are the risks? You know, and let's say that, you know, you got payroll bureau A that's using, as these guys were, the Iris, you know, which is a well established software company. You know, they're using their software. They've got a secure portal for transferring payslips and P60s and payroll information around. That's one scenario. What are the risks associated with that compared to a different payroll bureau that does everything on bits of paper and Excel, and they've got a file server in a shed at the bottom of one person's garden? Different again, isn't it? Well, how are you going to get under the skin of that? This is the thing. And you send a questionnaire, you know, detailed questionnaire to a relatively small but supremely professional organization, and they might struggle with it. You know, you might send a question for a massive organization, they might ignore it, you know.
Yeah.
And I think the questionnaire, we've got like 35 questions on our questionnaire, and some of it I don't think is relevant. So it's due for getting a review and a rebuild, because I think you're right, Joe, it's horses for courses. And I think the starting point is, what could go wrong with this processing? You know, how, you know, what's the impact of it getting compromised, and what's the likelihood of it getting compromised given the setup that the organization has got? And on this accountability tracker, you know, the process of due diligence checks, you carry out due diligence checks to guarantee the process, to guarantee, easy said than done, the process will implement appropriate technical and organizational measures. Okay, fine, we're going to implement tech and org measures. You know, the next step is, well, how good are they? Are they appropriate? And this does say, you know, build in due diligence checks proportionate to the risk of the processing before you agree a contract. So we do have flexibility. I'm expecting flexibility. It goes on to say due diligence process includes data security checks, e.g. site visits. I'm going to go to California. I'll do all the overseas ones, please. You can do Bradford. Nothing wrong with Bradford. You can do Bradford and places like that. You know, system testing, audit requests. But this is a time-consuming process. Into, you know, might have 200 processes. It's a very time-consuming process. Saying that, we've had 5 years to get these things in place, but it's not meant to be, according to this, a frivolous tick box exercise. It's meant to be a, you know, thorough, you know, system testing and auditing. You can pick a lot from looking at, you know, bigger companies' websites. You often have a trust site with a lot of documentation on there, and you can take some comfort in the fact they might have SOC 1, SOC 2, SOC 3, ISO, whatever. But you know, where that isn't there, you're relying on trying to the person receiving your questionnaire to understand the question you're asking as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is also one of the problems with the questionnaire. I read through the stuff with Vicky, and I said, well, no wonder they put this in. You know, it's a bit ambiguous question in layperson's terms.
Yeah, often see people not really understanding the question, don't you, and kind of just putting things in there just for the sake of it, so that they kind of just put an answer, don't they, and expect that to be the end of it. But it's,
yeah,
you know,
I see that.
The questions need to be answered properly, don't they?
I see that with DPAs as well. You know, if the DPA is provided to the let's say just project manager, you know, that doesn't have data protection experience, they don't understand how to answer the questions from a data protection standpoint, and that, you know, it provides difficulties in identifying the risk. And that's where we'll get some back and forth. I end up just taking a call with the individual to talk them through how you actually complete it and what we're looking for. Because it's a complicated thing to expect, you know, the layperson or non-data protection expert to know.
Yeah, I'm sure I've seen the ICO be critical of someone's due diligence. I'm sure recently there was a breach and they said, oh, we've done our due diligence, look, and they said, well, that's rubbish. I can't remember exactly which it was, but so, you know, they will take it, looks like they will take it seriously. You know, they will say they're critical of DPIAs, weren't they, the other week with, again, I can't remember which, you know, my memory's like, which monetary penalty notice, but they already did a DPIA. ICO says, yeah, but it was rubbish. What's it worth that paper is written on?
I think that's something it's important to reaffirm that, isn't it? That, you know, it's one thing doing saying you've done a DPIA or you've carried out due diligence, but you need to make sure that it's effective and done properly. Otherwise, there's just no point doing it at all.
Mm. Well, that's right. It's a false sense of security, isn't it? You think you've got things covered, and if in fact, you know,
comes back down to that tick box exercise, and you know, we are fully compliant. It's not how it works. It's not how it should work. It should be that culture of data protection by design and default.
Yeah, tick box mindset more than anything, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly. So I think we've touched on this a little bit, but the next one is risks and DPIAs.
Just looking at the time, Jasmine, do you want to
into one?
We've only got 2 minutes left. Shall we have part three? I mean, I can waste 2 minutes by just saying. So how would you approach due diligence? I think my take on it is probably a two-step approach. I think your first one is to look on the website of the organisation and have a look what you can find in the policies and the procedures, if there's anything on there. And then at that point, then if you want to find out more or need to find out more, then reach out to the organisation and, you know, and ask to see physically some evidence of the things they've said they've got in place. But I think that would then, my appetite of looking and then going and asking the organisation would probably depend on the processing that I'm doing. You know, I touched on earlier that if you're just doing low level processing of just names and contact details, you know, you're probably not really that interested in terms of finding out, you know, if they've got a information security management policy or something like that. Whereas if it's doing large scale processing of special category data, you know, you're going to want to ask for those sort of things.
Yeah, maybe it would be effective to have a way of categorizing processes or potential, you know, suppliers and processes by what they provide. And then from there, you can determine what are the more relevant questions, because it might be hard for, you know, somebody in procurement to know off the top of the head, OK, these are the kinds of things that we need to look for. And that might grow over time, or they could have the support of the data protection lead. But if it could be split into separate categories, maybe like a, you know, a yes, no kind of flow chart to get to a specific category. So for example, a system provider, you might want to look at the security measures more and what they've got in place around that, or how you can access rights through it and things like that. Obviously there will be overlap with all of them. Security is an important measure for any organization, but it could make the process more relevant. I don't know, it's a thought.
What's your thoughts, Phil?
Well, I suppose I wasn't listening. I was reading the accountability link that Lawrence has put in there, which I rather like, actually. I think it's quite good to look at it, this link here, and to think about these four different kind of examples, ways of thinking about accountability. I like this kind of stuff because it does make you read this external stuff, you know, because this isn't relating specifically to data protection compliance, and then think about it in our context and relate it back to it. So thank you for that. So I think it's really good, a good link and a good way of summarizing it.
Yeah, Lawrence also said he's made a really good point. Due diligence is at a number of points. Procurement, do they have a way to check or screen out suppliers without basics, i.e. privacy policy, security policy training? Next, you have legal diligence. Is the contract correct? Contains appropriate clauses and indemnities? Next, you have information security. Can your ICT vouch for their security or understand how they're going to keep the data secure? Finally, we have the DPA crew to look at the privacy policy, DPIA, and DPA policy and procedure, i.e. privacy notice, I believe.
And that's a nice structure, that. And having your ICT team look at the security is probably more effective than having your data protection officer look at the security.
No, I like that. So yeah, but, well, I guess that concludes the session.
Are you going to go both crawl under a rock now and get some shut eye?
Or on the desk.
Maybe. Yeah.
The youth of
today. Thanks for sticking with us, everyone.
I was going to say that. Thanks for bearing with us. Yeah. We apologise.
Hello.
Back we'll to be... our fresh selves next Friday,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Top form.
So we've got planned next week, isn't it? Busy week. I've got to go to Clacton on Sea on Monday and Tuesday, which will be interesting.
You're all over the shop, Phil.
Is this another holiday? Phil, or are you auditing? Are you?
No, and it's. No, it's not looking up. No, actually, what I'm doing, I'm going to see a local authority and I'm going to find out more about the Freedom of Information Act and what they did to prepare for it, specifically to apply that to the access to information scheme that is in the housing bill. So we've got a service we're launching to help people get their heads around the access to information scheme and to do something about it. What I'm doing is a fact-finding mission to go back to 2000, when the FOIA came into effect, to, you know, step through the processes, the tools, the outcomes, the workload, so we can, you know, help people to get their heads around what they need to do. So that's what I am on Tuesday, and then I think I'm back in the office some point next week.
Let me know how it goes.
Not a holiday.
No, I'm really intrigued by that. I'm excited to get something in place for the access to information scheme. I don't know about you, Joe, but I've been getting asked loads. I don't know if Phil's frozen.
Why would I be getting asked, Jasmine?
But oh, true, you are on a
sabbatical.
Yeah.
Not quite, but I'm on a DPP sabbatical at the moment, aren't I? So yeah. I feel very out of touch at the minute with the, you know, the things that are going on in the world of data protection. This is the only thing really that's giving me a bit of a kick up the backside. So. Yeah.
I can give you a kick to the backside anytime you want, Joe. You just, when I'm next in the office, you just shout up. I'll put my big boots on. Anyway, we've gone over and over and over time, Jasmine. You need to get a grip of this and bring it to a close.
So thank you, everyone, for this session and for bearing with us. Honestly, it's appreciated. Please come back. But have a great weekend. We'll be back next week for a GDPR radio session. And yeah, thank you again for joining. Have a good one.
Cheers, guys. See you later.
Thank you. Yeah, bye.
Bye.